Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. We're really glad you're joining us today. My name is Kirk Chisholm, the host of today's show. We have an exciting show for you today. Today we are going to be talking about debt resolution and bankruptcy with Leslie Tain. I'm really excited to dig into some of these secrets with her. But before we talk to Leslie, let's hear from our sponsor. Are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right fit for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. So today we're talking with Leslie. How are you doing today, Leslie?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Before we dig in here, maybe you can tell listeners a little bit about yourself because you have an interesting background.
Sure. So I'm a financial attorney and I have been one for over 20 years. I started out as in-house counsel to a national debt company and then branched out and started my own practice focusing in on helping consumers and business owners with debt and alternatives to bankruptcy. My practice has grown exponentially over the years since so many people have financial and debt-related issues that we resolve. And lately, my business has really exploded in the student loan arena and helping people manage that. But we have four offices now in Long Island, Westchester, Manhattan, and we are opening up in South Florida. And I'm also the author of Life and Debt, a book about how to live with and love your debt.
Great. Well, that actually brings up an interesting topic. I was curious. You talk a lot about learning to love your debt. What do you mean by that? Because I have not heard anybody else take that tact about debt. I don't know anybody who really loves their debt, but how do you describe it?
So it's definitely a fresh approach, but the reason why I believe in learning to love your debt is because it can work for you. Debt doesn't all have to be bad and have this negative connotation of a problem. Debt can be something that helps you get your education. It can help you get your car. It gets you the home that you live in. It can get you all kinds of things that really help improve your life. So I look at it like it's an opportunity to change the energy around your debt. So I look forward to getting my bills. I can pay them, thankfully. I appreciate the fact that a bank felt I was trustworthy enough to be lent money and that I can pay those bills and that I benefit from my debt. So I look at it as a positive thing.
Yeah, that's great because I know that there are a lot of people out there who are educators to the public about debt. And, I have a few friends who really kind of focus on that as a niche. And what's interesting is most people who are focused on debt, they're focused on debt is bad. Debt is evil. Like you don't want to have any debt, get rid of it. But, you know, as you point out, there are some benefits to having debt. Like what are some of those more responsible uses of debt?
The most responsible use of debt is taking it on when you know you can pay it. So when you take it on blindly and you really have no ability to repay it, or you think you might have the ability to repay it, then that's really irresponsible. When you don't budget and you don't understand how that particular debt will impact your finances, that is completely irresponsible as far as your financial goals, because you can't just fly by the seat of your pants when it comes to trying to pay certain debts. Yes, of course, people do that all the time when it comes to credit cards because you can make the minimum payment and you're not required to pay for everything that you purchased at the time that you purchased it or when the bill comes. Unlike a car payment or a house or a home, when you have to pay the whole payment and you can't then, you know, pay a piece of that, you have to pay the whole thing when it's due, or they could repossess your home or your car or some particular item that you used as collateral for the loan. But again, if you haven't budgeted and you haven't figured out whether that loan fits within your finances, meaning that it's a comfortable dollar amount to repay and there's not going to be any surprises with that, then if you haven't figured that out, then you're really not taking on debt responsibly. You really have to understand how much you can afford. How does that impact your finances, your credit, your future? What kind of debts you might need to take on? You know, do you have kids who are teenagers and 3 years from now they're going to go to college, but you're going to take on a personal loan to pay off credit cards, and now that's going to have a balloon payment right when the kids are going to college, so therefore you're not going to have the money to pay for college. That's not very responsible.
You and I are probably from the same generation, but I know when I was growing up, debt was looked as a bad thing. Like, you didn't take on debt unless you absolutely had to. I look at our society now, and nobody saves money first. Everybody looks at the payments. What's it going to cost? I mean, look at iPhones, for instance. They're so expensive now, they don't even give you the price. They just say, oh, it's going to be, you know, $20 a month for 2 years. People are living off payments versus the saving and buying things outright. How do you see kind of the younger generation dealing with that? Because they're looking at it from a much different perspective.
Right. Well, that's what happened years ago. That trend started with buy now, pay later, or it's just a payment, which is when car leasing came out, you know, long before the younger generation could even remember. And that's what made getting some of these cars more affordable. It's the same thing when it comes to people who've grown up with that mentality that it's just a payment. They don't see the totality of the debt as being impactful because it's just a payment. And that's what ends up starting a really bad process for managing money, because it's not just a payment. You have multiple A payments. And when you have multiple payments for multiple issues or multiple debts, that adds up to a substantial amount of expenses. Also, what are you getting for that? You know, if you're just leasing or you're just paying for certain things, what are you getting from that? And that mentality of just taking on a payment isn't really a healthy mentality, because the truth is that the buy now, pay later, or the buy now and pay it off is a very dangerous position to take, because if you don't have a backup plan, if something happens where you lost your job or you don't have the requisite funds because you needed money for medical expenses or something that came up, then you're in a situation where this perpetual payment arena becomes problematic, where there's no end to ever making payments on items.
Yeah. I mean, people don't look how much the car costs. They look at how much, you know, their lease payment is or their monthly payment is, which, you know, I think is probably not the most appropriate way to buy a car. But it kind of feels like that tends to be the common way to do it. But I guess getting back to your loving your debt, I mean, mostly what you're talking about is like a mindset shift for people. How does debt affect most people's money mindset?
What ends up happening when you start to accumulate debt and you're making lots of payments, that there's a stress factor that goes into that. And it starts to become a negative thought process. Oh, I don't want to go to the mailbox because my bills are coming, or I have this to pay. I have to pay this. I have to pay that. And there's a lot of negativity surrounding it. So if you change your mindset about it and you write it out and you say, okay, I have my house payment, my car payment, insurance, cell phone, all these payments, then you say, all right, how does this benefit me? You know, this is a good thing, not a bad thing, and not looking at like, oh, I have that mortgage again. If you look at it like that, then maybe it's time to examine that particular debt and say, is this working for me? Is my car payment making sense, or is it becoming a burden for me, not only financially, but emotionally? Because you have to remember that what goes along with debt is a negative mindset. And if you could switch the mindset as a result of making good financial decisions and saying, you know what, I got this new car, I feel really good about it, it fits right in my budget, I know I can make the payment every single month comfortably, then it's something that's going to make you feel good. But if you go out and you say, all right, I took on this car because I really wanted it, and oops, you know, I'm having difficulty making the payments now because it's a burden and it's challenging me financially, it's just going to turn into a negative mindset. So yeah, when you take on the debt in the beginning, you know, it's important to not be impulsive about it. It's important to understand that no matter what debt you're taking on, that you understand whether it's something that's affordable. And that goes for purchases on credit cards, it goes for cars, everything that you purchase. So I know when I go into a store, whether the purchases I make are affordable because I've thought about it ahead of time. If you make those purchases impulsively without really thinking about, you know, whether you could afford it, or knowing in the back of your mind that you may not be able to afford it, then you're going to be in this negative mindset because there's a lot of negativity surrounding the purchase to begin with.
Yeah. And kind of getting into the deeper reaches of that. I mean, you know, if things go wrong, then obviously it can harm people's credit, or worst case, they can get into bankruptcy. I think probably would be useful for people is understanding maybe the bankruptcy process and the debt resolution process. Just, I mean, there are people who obviously have experienced that firsthand, but there are a lot of people who haven't or maybe curious. So how does the bankruptcy process work, and what are some of the things that go on there?
So we try to, at my firm, try to help people stay out of bankruptcy. I believe strongly that bankruptcy should be a last resort, and that many times bankruptcy really isn't the best option, that there are a lot of options that provide flexibility and more control over the process. As a general rule for consumer bankruptcies, there's two different types. One is a Chapter 7 and one is called a Chapter 13. A Chapter 7 is generally where all of your debts would be wiped out. You need to meet what's called a means test, and that means test is different depending on the jurisdiction that you live in, and that's there's a formula and it's calculated. The same goes for a Chapter 13. There is a means test as well. It's just calculated differently. And as far as the process for Chapter 13, it's a repayment plan. And what you would do is submit a repayment of the debts, a portion of the repayment of the debts, to the Chapter 13 bankruptcy trustee in federal court. Both matters would be in federal court. The difference is one is shorter than the other, and one wipes out all the debts, and the other one, like a Chapter 13, you could be responsible for paying 100%, 100 cents on the dollar to all of your creditors back. And under those circumstances, truthfully, there are many other options, including what my firm concentrates in, which is a debt consolidation and debt resolution process where we reduce the balances that are owed to your creditors, eliminate the interest, and pay back a portion of the debts over a period of time. It doesn't have the same impact as a bankruptcy. It's not reported the same on the credit report, and your hands aren't tied financially during the course of the process. And in fact, there's so much flexibility that it allows you to pay it off without any prepayment penalty or interest. And since it's not a loan, and it's not a bankruptcy. And that really is very appealing to a lot of people who either can't file bankruptcy because of their jobs. Maybe they have a certain security clearance. They're in the banking industry. They have Series 7s or other type of licensing requirements that would negate the ability to use bankruptcy as an option. And also other people that have equity in their homes and other assets that could be taken from you if you were to file bankruptcy. So, and then just obviously the principle that many people come to me and say, I don't want to file bankruptcy. I don't feel good about that. I would feel better knowing that I was able to work with my creditors and provide another type of resolution to my financial situation without being so drastic as to file the bankruptcy. But those are two basic types. There's also something called a Chapter 11, which is used in business and reorganizational situations. But as a general rule, the other two are consumer-based, and that's what most people would be faced with. Again, there's a means test. You'd have to speak to a bankruptcy attorney in your area to determine whether you qualify. It's often based on household income and the number of members of the household. So with that said, there are other options. Bankruptcy is not the only way to go. And I encourage you as a consumer, and when you're considering that, to look into other options before you file bankruptcy and at least feel like an informed and educated consumer when you make the decision. It's not that it's wrong for everybody. It does work under certain circumstances. But in many cases, I see that bankruptcy is not the best alternative and that there are other ways to resolve your debt.
Yeah, that's great. It's funny because well, it's not funny, but I've talked to, you know, a few people in the past that work in real estate, and a lot of their properties that they acquire for people who are in, you know, financial hard times. You know, what they tell me is they say there's a lot of people out there who they own a house, they come across hard times, and they just shut down. They just stop. Like, they could make a lot of smart financial decisions, logical decisions, but when they get overwhelmed with debt, they just kind of shut down. They end up making no decision, which ends up being the worst decision they could make. It's interesting because it's really hard to kind of match the two up. How would you recommend that people deal with that aspect of it? Because it's obviously not a logical thing. It's a kind of an emotional overwhelm situation. So what are some ways that people can kind of handle that and maybe make good financial decisions?
So I see that pretty often, that once you get into that mindset of, uh-oh, I can't pay this bill, or, you know, I don't have the requisite funds and I need, you know, I'm feeling like I need to take a loan or refinance my house, you get into a mindset of a little bit of desperation and you start not to think very clearly. And it's not uncommon. So I would encourage people to understand that, don't beat yourself up about it. It is normal that you are going through a difficult time in making a clear decision because you're entrenched with it. And as soon as emotions get involved with these decisions, it becomes paralyzing. You can't eat right, sleep right. You're arguing with a spouse, you know, there, or a business partner. It's normal. And it happens. And I would say that's the time to say, listen, you know, I'm not able to make a good decision here. I'm struggling. I need some help. I need to reach out to somebody who can help me make some good decisions, or at least help clear out what's going on. And I can't tell you how often people sit with me and say, oh my God, this was the best thing I ever did, because now at least there's somebody who can see things from a bird's eye view, who's not entrenched emotionally in the situation and can see, you know, I can see things that most people can't financially when they're going through the situation, because it is really a difficult time. And, you know, it's not the only thing that's going on in your life, and you're battling a lot of little fires, and it's not an easy task, and it takes its toll, and it's emotionally overwhelming. And, you know, it's a downward spiral of feeling badly for yourself and your situation, letting your spouse or your family down, and feeling like you're a failure at managing your money. And I can tell you that that's all a mindset that we try to fix. And even though I'm not a psychologist, there's a lot of therapy that goes into helping people with their debt, because it is a debilitating mindset when you get in debt and you're having difficulty paying your bills and maybe creditors are calling you. You just feel terrible. I am completely non-judgmental. I'm like a doctor. So I don't look at you. I'm not going to blame anybody or any situation. I would like to help somebody understand how they got in the situation so that we can make better decisions going forward. So I'm very positive about it. And I know that I can help people. So from that perspective, I would encourage you not to feel so down that there's no light at the end of the tunnel, because there really is. And I know that it's difficult to talk to people who might be angry at you for being in that situation, but, you know, reach out, find somebody who's an experienced financial attorney or accountant who can look at your situation and help make some suggestions that can guide you to new strategies to resolve what's going on.
So it brings up a good point, because there's this balance where people have control and then they don't have control, and it's not a black and white thing. So it's not like people are going to know, oh, okay, now is the time I need to reach out. So what do you recommend for people as kind of a guideline for when they should start considering finding somebody like you or reaching out to their accountant or what have you to help resolve this?
So immediately I'm going to say the first red flag is when you start to feel, uh-oh, what am I going to do now? How am I going to fix this? There's a lot of self-help going on when it comes to debt. Either you're researching it online, you're reading lots of information, maybe you are talking to your accountant or your business partner or your spouse. But the moment you feel, uh-oh, you know, I feel a little pain here, that's the time to say, certainly to come to me. That's not the time that most people do come to me. They usually wait till it's very painful and there's a lot of what I would call financial illness. Ideally, if I could say and get somebody early enough, it would be when they're starting to take on the debt. But you know, human nature, that's just not going to happen. So being realistic about the situation, the moment you start get a bill and you say, how am I going to pay this? Where's the money going to come from? Or, oops, I just paid this bill. How am I going to pay that bill? As soon as that starts to happen, that's the time to start thinking about, you know what? I think I need some help here. If you try to fix that yourself, self-help, eventually you're going to be here anyway. You're just going to be here with more debt.
Yeah, and that's a great point. You know, another part of the process that I think is also more generational, but becoming an increasingly large problem, is student debt. Not only because, you know, nobody's paying for college anymore, they're all taking out loans. And of course, college is increasing, feels like exponentially. But the other problems, I mean, student loans, I mean, if you're talking about resolution, there's a lot fewer options. You can talk about how people deal with student loan issues.
Sure. Student loans is a huge epidemic. my business has exploded with student loan matters. The real issue with the student loan is not realizing that everybody knows this cost going into college. Listen, I have 3 children in college and 2 stepchildren all in college at the same time. So nobody understands it better than I do, aside from the fact that I resolve student loan debt regularly. But the truth is that the kids today, they don't really care what school costs. And I don't blame them, because the truth is a 17-year-old, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old has no concept of what 40, 50, 80 grand costs, what that is, and what it's like to make and earn that kind of money. The real guidance has to come from the parent, where the parent says, listen, early on in high school, and say, listen, you know, we're going to start talking about college. There's a cost to going to school. This is what we could afford. And you're going to need to stay within that budget. Otherwise, you know, not otherwise, you're going to have to take student loans, because the truth is a student on their own can't get all those loans to pay for school. They need to be co-signed. You can get federal loans that don't need to be co-signed, but there's a limitation to the amount of those loans. And when they fall short, you have to go into private student loans and additional loans that require co-signers. And that means a parent, grandparent, or relative or somebody has to sign for those loans. And that co-signer will be equally responsible for that debt should that debtor, should the borrower not pay it. And that will impact your debt-to-income ratio. It will impact your credit score. It will impact your ability to get other loans. And that needs to be made aware of. And today, frankly, a lot of the schools are offering scholarships and other opportunities to reduce the cost of going to school. And it's a business decision. What kind of career are you looking at? Are you thinking about going to graduate school? Then maybe you should start out at a community college or a state program where the programs are considerably less money and you're still getting a terrific education. And then you can go on to graduate school wherever you want, limiting your financial exposure. Again, you also have to think about the type of career that you're going to have or that your child is going to have. You know, if they want to be a social worker, which is a great field, but there's a limitation to the amount of money that they want, that they can earn. And you're going to go to school for $70,000 a year, but your average income is about $50,000. How do you expect to pay off $280,000 plus your graduate program? It really becomes impossible. And then the cycle is, well, you know, I'm in student loan debt, but it should be forgiven. But you took it and you voluntarily took it and you received a benefit for it. You went to school and you got a degree that helped you build your career. So understanding, you know, the differences between the type of loans that are out there, understanding whether at some point in the future, are you going to be able to pay back these loans without it impacting you? Are you going to have to live at home with your parents after school? You know, I have a kid who came to me, she's not a kid, she's in her 20s, but she makes $45,000 a year and her payments on the private student loans are $1,800 a month. I mean, honestly, how is she going to pay that? And live? She can't live on her own. She has to live with her family. And how is she going to pay that? And that's not $1,800 this year and it goes down. That's $1,800 and it's going to continue for years and years and years on private student loans for just undergraduate. So understand, like, what do the dollars mean to you when you graduate from college? And yes, I understand that before they take the loans, there's an educational seminar that has to be gone through before you say yes to the loans. But who's really understanding that? Is it you or the parent, the student or the parent, and understanding what the impact of it is? Now, you know, college is not unaffordable. It's affordable. But if you choose to go to schools where, you know, listen, I asked a kid once why they chose the school that they chose. And they said they liked the lake in the middle of the school. And that's why they chose it. And, you know, if you're going to choose your debt based on that, because you like that you could canoe or that they put up hammocks and bring in puppy dogs during finals week, you know, that's all good and well. And those are things that my kids also, and I'm not unrealistic about it. My children also were very drawn to schools that, you know, had those type of things. They thought those were the greatest things they've ever seen. And I get it. But that's not why we're going to college. That's a benefit of being there, but that's not why we're going. And in my situation, for my children, I do pay for college. I had them take the federal loans to benefit them so that we could start paying them back so that it looks good on their credit that they took on a debt in college young and that it was being repaid during college. So what I'm saying is you have the option of starting to repay those loans while you're in school, even though you're not required required to do so. So my children are paying back those loans while they're in school and at small rates in order to minimize the amount of debt, in order to build up credit, and in order to show that there is a level of responsibility and buy-in by the student so that it's not just a big free-for-all. And let me tell you, it has nothing to do with money. It has to do with values, and it has to do with what I was willing to do for the kids and what I felt was a good investment. And I believe, obviously, I believe college is an excellent investment, but if my children want to go to graduate school, then we're going to take a look at what we're doing for undergraduate. And it's interesting because all of the children have different concepts and different ideas about what school they chose, why they chose it. And honestly, they have no concept of the money. And I don't blame the kids and the students at all that you had no idea what you were signing. I totally get it. There's no way you could understand that. It's actually complex finances. And for you to take on debt at 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 of that magnitude, it's in some ways it's unfair because you really don't know what you're signing and what you're getting into. And there's no statute of limitations on the collectability of student loans, which means that it's not like the debts expire and the creditor is not going to get their money. They're going to come after you and they're going to come after your co-signers. And I have elderly people who have their Social Security garnished to pay student loans. And that can happen. You can have your wages garnished. You can have your tax refund money taken away. You can have your Social Security garnished. So with all that said, I can understand that when you're young, you have no idea what that even means or that Social Security is even a concept. But you have co-signers. And those co-signers should be more responsible financially to help guide you as a student to making better decisions. And yes, there's financial aid to help you make decisions about loans that you're taking, but financial aid is not there to help you decide if it's in your best interest whether to take the loans. They're only there to help you decide which loans to take and where to access resources for loans. So I understand that it's not your fault that you got into debt, but you have somebody's got to be there to guide you. And I would encourage you, whoever's listening, as a parent, a peer, an older sibling, a relative, that have a discussion about what that means by taking on debt and the limitations. Like I told my daughter, she used to say, I want to move into New York City when I graduate. And I said, if you go to school and it costs this amount of money, you're not going to live in Manhattan. You're going to be living at home after school. And all your friends are going to be in the city and you're going to be living at home paying for those debts. That's something to think about. You got to put it in realistic terms for them.
Yeah. I mean, parents' responsibility is a big part of this because it's not, as you said, the kids aren't really responsible at that age. And, you know, when I was that age, I mean, you're not. You don't have any concept of these things because if you had a job, a summer job, I mean, that doesn't, it counts, but it doesn't really count because you're not making any meaningful money, not compared to, I mean, I don't know. I mean, some colleges cost 70 grand a year now. It's just, it's absurd to even think about.
And that's true. And the truth is you're just coming out of high school. You live with your parents. All your bills were paid. You didn't have to worry about paying bills. And all of a sudden you're thrust into a situation. But $70,000 to go to undergraduate is a lot of money. And there has to be a real big benefit, in my opinion, to pay that kind of money for an undergraduate program. And there are benefits and there are certain circumstances where it makes sense. I'm not saying across the board it doesn't, but for some of the people that I see and the choices that they make, those are not the best choices. And I see people struggle. I mean, I have people call me all the time and say, how am I going to pay for next semester for my kid? You know, I guess I'll just take a loan at 11%. I mean, come on. That's crazy. People refinance their houses over a quarter, an eighth of a percentage, and you're going to worry about refinancing your home, and then you're going to end up with an 11% interest rate on a loan for school. So think about what that's actually going to cost you if you figured out the amortization schedule on something like that, meaning what the actual cost of school is. It's not 70 grand, it's probably 100 grand when you figure out that schedule and how to pay that back.
You're touching on a societal hot button right now, and I know there's a lot of politics being talked about this concept, which I think is probably more soapbox than anything else, but it's a real problem.
There are ways to fix it. There are ways to fix student loan debt. Believe me, I can fix them. So know what you have and seek out some help on it for sure.
That's great. Well, we really appreciate your insight here, Leslie. And any final thoughts on how people can find you or any final thoughts you have for listeners?
Sure. You can certainly visit me at our website at taynelaw.com, TAYNELAW.com. You can find me personally on Twitter at Leslie H. Tain ESQ and on LinkedIn, of course. And the Tain Law Group's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Tain Law Group. We always have lots of puppy pictures because I raise dogs for the Guide Dog Foundation and America's Vet Dog. So we always have lots of fun puppy pictures and a good time here at the office. And I'm always accessible. So we do all phone consultations for free. So if you ever think that you have any kind of question related to debt, don't hesitate to find me.
Now we're going into the panel portion of our show. And we have a great panel today. We have Miranda this week. How you doing, Miranda?
Hey, how's it going?
We also have Kelly Coughlin this week. Kelly, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking.
And we also have a new member to the panel, Natalie Pine. How's it going, Natalie?
Hi, good.
Good. Because people don't quite know you yet, Natalie. So why don't you tell us a little about yourself and your background?
I currently run a RIA in College Station, Texas, focusing on university professors. But my background is I worked in London as an investment banker and for a distressed debt hedge fund for 5 years before coming into the financial advisory business.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad we have you this week because your background is going to be invaluable to this conversation about debt resolution and bankruptcy. I noticed you didn't say which investment banker you worked for, which I'll leave that up to the viewer's imagination.
I worked for Goldman Sachs.
All right.
Let's talk about some of these topics that Leslie had mentioned because the debt resolution topic is very interesting. I mean, some people certainly have debt and other people don't, but I know there's some kind of hot topic areas that I wanted to get into on the show here. So let's start with you, Miranda. Do you love your debt?
Actually, I kind of do. So I kind of have, you know, a take on this where it's about what is my money doing for me? Where is it going to be put to the most use? So for instance, I still have student loans and I'm not trying to pay them down early. Everybody gasped in horror and shock because they have a 1.9% interest rate and the interest is tax deductible for me. When you pay down your debt, you are getting a guaranteed return of, you know, they say is, you know, the whole thing is, oh, well, if you pay down your debt, that's a guaranteed return. And so I can have a guaranteed return of 1.9% or I can invest my money and get a much bigger return. So I actually have made the choice to just pay my student loan debt down on schedule with this nice 1.9% interest rate and put the rest of my money instead of going to paying down the student loan debt into investing. So it, you know, it's invested in my travel fund, it's invested in my retirement. So it's invested in all these things that actually provide me with a much higher rate of return on my money and gives me time in the market. I take a similar tack when I'm buying cars. I buy cars for a long time. Like the car I have now is I've had for almost 10 years. You know, I bought it with a loan, but it was, you know, special financing. It was 0.9% financing. And so do I want to put a big chunk of my capital into this car that's a depreciating asset? Or do I get a loan at this low interest rate and put the rest of my money to work for me once again in investing? So I think it really depends on whether you have, you know, well, first of all, the stomach for debt. Some people just do not want to do the debt. They don't like the debt and they have that knot in their stomach. And I understand that and that's totally fine. But for me, it really is a numbers calculation. And where is my money going to do me the most good? Where is it going to earn me the most? And can I leverage, you know, my money and my good credit for these low interest rates that allow me to do these other things? So that's kind of how I look at it. I don't say, hey, carrying a credit card balance is awesome because what you've got there is, you know, you've got like a 17.99% interest rate. I'm not beating that in the market. I'm not carrying a credit card balance. So I really look at the math. I really look at the numbers and say, where is my money going to do me the most good?
Yeah. And I think that's a great perspective. I know when I hear when people talk about debt, usually it's kind of a binary approach. It's either, you know, all good or all bad. But a lot of people haven't taken kind of like a thoughtful approach to it. So certainly appreciate that, Miranda. I am going to want to know where you're getting your 1.9% rate on student loans, though. I'm pretty sure they're not at that rate.
It's
right
because
now.
I'm old. and like my undergraduate loans like were finished before the direct loan program. So like it's because I'm old. It's because my student loan debt is from pre-2005. You know, it was back when private lenders were part of the origination process and part of the whole game, and before the stock market crash and recession of 2008, 2009. So that's why I have low interest rates on my student loans, is because I'm old.
Well, for reference, Miranda's actually not old, but in a non-awkward segue, let's talk to Kelly. Kelly, do you love your debt?
Well, I don't want to be Debbie Downer on this, so you'll have to forgive me with that. No, I hate debt. And frankly, with all due respect to all participants, current and recorded participant, I think people should learn to hate debt.
That's cool. And do it.
Yeah. Well, there are two reasons.
Let your hate flow through you.
Yeah, let the hate flow through. There are two reasons. Number one, I'll just cover the first one so I don't talk too much in my first round here. I think too many people today not only love debt, but they're addicted to it. It's kind of like a drug. They can get what they want now, and they really don't have to earn the income or generate the revenues to pay for it. They can get it now. When that happens, I think the value for the goods and services, you know, the value as kind of measured by how much effort did I have to put into to get this cell phone upgrade, which, you know, let's face it, it is a debt. It's an encumbrance on future earnings or future income. The values for goods and services kind of get really distorted. And well, if I didn't really have to work hard for that car with a $250 lease for 25 years, it's no big deal. And then that leads to the second point, which I'll put on the back burner for right now. Debt is about the future, and it's a contract, and contracts restrict us for our future. They restrict our flexibility for what we can do in the future, whether it be, I guess I was going to not talk about this, but it kind of restricts us. We can't, when I had a whopping $7,000 college debt when I finished undergraduate school, and a lot of my friends didn't have debt, and I wanted to go to Europe for 3 years, but I had to go for a measly 9 months because at that time you could defer your college loan payments, didn't start for 9 months. And so I wanted to horse around for 9 months, but I had to get back to start paying off my stupid college debt. And I did that for, it seemed like 10 years.
Only 9 months, Kelly? That's all you're horsing around for? Aren't you still doing that?
I was going to say, I don't see any evidence that you've stopped horsing around.
Well, I hope so. I hope that's the case. But anyway, that's kind of my perspective on it. I think we're too addicted to it. And I don't like that these contracts, whether it be a cell phone contract or a lease payment or a college loan debt, how it restricts us.
Yeah, I mean, you raise some good points, Kelly, because debt from the negative perspective, you know, a lot of people are addicted to debt because they're going on their interest payments. You know, when people are buying a car, they're not looking at how much the car costs, they're looking at how much the payments are, which once we kind of get used to that kind of mentality where you're looking at payments versus the cost, people don't look at the cost. And in my opinion, that's one reason why I think college is so expensive, because the costs are well beyond people's expectations. So just looking at how they can pay for the payments. But let's talk to Natalie. What are your thoughts on this, Natalie? Do you love your debt?
So I actually don't have any. And the reason is I'm probably more in Kelly's camp than Miranda's. I think you need to have the money before you go and purchase something. So if you're using it as a tool, which it sounds like Miranda is, you have low interest rates and you are investing that money. And so it is a financial transaction. That's a different story than buying something that you can't afford, that you don't have the money for. So I'm more in the camp of maybe you can use debt as a tool, but you should have saved the money to buy whatever that thing is. Or it can be a tool if you can't afford, say, your house, that you use debt as a tool, but it really shouldn't be something where you're overspending, because you end up spending twice, three times. I mean, Leslie mentioned that you spend so much more for all of those goods than you would if you paid cash for it. So ultimately, you know, that return accumulates over time and you end up being way better off if you are not using debt in the way of, you know, these huge interest rates. And but it can't, I mean, it definitely can be a tool that you use if you're making more on your money as opposed to bringing forward spending that ultimately, you know, you're going to have to pay off in the future at some point. And people get into real trouble, you know, with that snowball of, I'm just going to upgrade that one thing and I'm just going to buy that one thing. And then all of a sudden it snowballs into something where they've brought forward all of their spending and, you know, they can't retire, or they can't help their kids, or they can't do something that they really want to do. And it's hard to love. What she was saying was love your debt, love the things that that debt purchased. It's hard to think about that, loving your car, when it's completely, everything you think about is how am I going to make that payment?
Yeah. And I'm not sure debt is something you necessarily love. I think what she was talking about was kind of like a money mindset of how to look at debt. Because I think debt is a negative impact on people's psyche, right? You have to pay these payments every month and you're like, ugh, I got to pay this thing again. And it just feels like it's endless, like a cell phone bill or cable bill. Mm-hmm. And one thing that certainly I appreciate, you know, Natalie, your and Kelly's opinion for the negative side of it, because I think, you know, mathematically, debt is not a positive thing. You're paying more than you have to pay. I kind of fall on Miranda's side a little bit because I think that, you know, there's different ways people can use debt if you're responsible about it. Responsibility obviously is a big, big challenge. And certainly young people have a tough time because they don't have experience with debt. And then by the time they do, it's too late and then they're kind of stuck. But, you know, debt can be used as Miranda says, leverage, right? If you're getting a Miranda rate for student loans or a car loan, the last time I got a car loan was like 0.9%.
Yeah, because it was a long time ago. And if you have really good credit, I mean, you might as well leverage that, right?
But yeah. It also is like you actually invested the money. What we see is a lot of times people have it in the bank earning absolutely nothing and they're not paying down their debt.
Right. And that's the problem.
Yeah, because if you're borrowing at 0.9% and you're investing it and making 5%, well, that's a good deal. Of course, you're taking more risk because, you know, you have to assume you're making 5% when, you know, you could obviously lose that money too. But if you know what you're doing, you're responsible, it's one way to do things. You know, another concept too, which I know a lot of people don't talk about, but people talk about this concept of an emergency fund and keeping cash for a rainy day. In the old days, that's what people used to do. But now it's easy to get a home equity line, and that could be a substitute for an emergency fund. I'm not suggesting people do this. I'm just suggesting it's an alternative if you have an emergency, that so few people have home equity lines just to have them and never use them. They usually get them when they need them, which of course is when they can't get them, you know, like changing a job or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I always recommend people have a home equity line, even if you don't use it. It doesn't cost you anything to keep. And if you need it, it's there and you don't have to keep cash sitting in your bank account earning 0%.
There's one, I'm going to challenge that, Kirk, a bit, because I think the concept of matching long-term assets with long-term liabilities and similarly short-term assets with short-term liabilities is missing, certainly with many consumers. The idea that, and I'm sure everybody knows, is that you don't want to be borrowing at, say, longer-term rates and taking on long-term debt to pay short-term, let's just say, short-term operating expenses. When I say I don't like debt and consumers are addicted to debt, I'm not really talking about long-term debt. You don't want an economy where people have to, they want to buy a home, and so they have to wait 25 years of saving $1,000 or $500 a month to pay cash for their home. I mean, that's madness. And similarly with a car, because a car presumably allows you to generate more income and, you know, go to work, that kind of stuff. So you don't want to foster a culture where people have to pay for long-term assets that could and should be paid for with long-term debt. The problem I think I have is that people are taking out, let's say, home equity loans that are, that and they access those home equity loans to pay for their trip to the Bahamas and to pay for their cell phone upgrade or, you know, that kind of stuff. I think that's where you got to be careful. You know, if you don't have the free cash flow from your income, from your non-debt encumbered income, then don't take the trip to the Bahamas, and maybe don't do the phone upgrade. College loans, student loans are kind of in between there. The only way a college loan investment makes sense is if you think that you're that $100,000 investment that you're going to make in your education, you can really, you're going to generate a premium on your income from that. If not, you better go to the community college, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good perspective, Kelly, in matching up short-term and long-term debt. And I think that's probably a perspective most people haven't thought of. And of course, you're the accountant on the show, and you're very knowledgeable in these areas, and certainly we love to use your services here.
Well, frankly, my grandmother probably would have said the same thing. So I don't think you need to be an accountant to get that, you know?
Well, I mean, but most people don't think of it in those terms, though. Like, that's naturally how you think of things, which is why you're good at your profession. Like, as a consumer, people aren't thinking, well, I got to match up my short term with my long term. Like, most people are just like, hey, how can I get that iPhone? They don't even want to do budgets, you know? Like, mm-hmm. people are very, you know, they're squirrels. Their attention span is like 5 seconds. They can't think that long term, which, you know, is why people need to work with professionals, because that's how, you know, we can help them in that way. But
no, I do agree, Kirk. I do agree with your concept of people should get a home equity line of credit lined up. You don't want to be trying to get a home equity line of credit once you lose your job. So get it in place, get access to credit when you don't need it. That's kind of the rule of thumb, right? Because banks won't lend you when you need it, right? They'll lend it to you when you don't need it. So get that set up beforehand, but don't use it.
Yeah. So I want to move into the debt resolution part, which, if you've dealt with this before, you've probably seen it. If you haven't, you're probably not knowledgeable about this at all. But I want to talk about like debt resolution. So, you know, debt resolution for people like Leslie, like, you know, she works with people who are trying to get out of debt and trying to work through different ways to do that. But there are a lot of scams out there. I know a lot of people get themselves into tough situations because they find a quote unquote solution, which happens to be someone who's taking advantage of them because they're in a rough spot. What about you, Natalie? Have you seen any, what scams have you seen in this area, or things that people should be watching out for with their going through debt resolution?
We haven't really seen a lot of scams, but I would say that we always point someone to someone like Leslie, a credible source. If we're looking at consolidating credit card debt or that kind of thing, is it, again, a reputable source? Vetting and not just taking it, this the same way, if you think about it, like you get scams all the time of, hey, you're going to win $1 million. I mean, you have to look at it through that lens that if it's too good to be true, more than likely, that's probably the case. You know, is it something that is going to be a little bit painful, that's reorganizing your payments and that kind of thing? Or is it like, hey, it's all going to be gone in a month, and so this should be fantastic for you? I mean, I think you have to be real, just look at it through the lens of, hey, this is something I have to assume is a scam, and be careful going into it.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for my $1 million check from that lottery. So
yeah, me too.
What about you, Miranda? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, just like Natalie said, you do have to be really careful about this whole situation, because there are a lot of folks. I mean, there's debt consolidation. If you have good credit, but you don't like the amount of debt you have, you might be able to get a loan at a very low interest rate to pay that off. But there are also these companies that, if you have poor credit, it's really easy to get in line with these debt settlement companies, because they make these promises, settle your debt for pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, oh my gosh, I'm drowning in debt. How can I get out of this debt? How can I settle my debt for pennies on the dollar? How can I just pay less and be done with it? And a lot of the way that these debt settlement companies work is you make payments to the debt settlement companies and you stop making payments to your creditors. Your creditors either send your stuff to collections, or they become more willing to make a deal because it's clear you're not paying your bills. What ends up happening is your credit score is totally tanked because you're not making payments on your debt. You're sending it to this debt settlement company. Eventually, they might settle your debt, or if they don't, there's a chance that the creditor can still sue you. You're not paying your debts. So you might be enrolled in this debt program and still get sued, but you've paid all your money to the debt program. it's really important to be very careful about how you approach debt resolution. You want to find a reputable source because you want to be able to find somebody who can actually help you. And one of the great places to do is the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, who can help you find accredited credit counselors who may not be helping you settle your debt, but they can sit down with you and say, well, let's work on a debt management plan. Let's work on a debt repayment plan. Let's figure out something that works in your budget and that we can get your debts paid down. And so starting there, it's nfcc.org. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling is a really good place to start and find people in your area who can help you get through that, potentially helping you protect your credit score a little bit, but also, you know, helping you work with your creditors in a way that, you know, might keep you from being sued.
Well, and one of the things that Leslie said is do it before you hit that desperation phase, when you can still see a little clearly and you're just that initial stage of, uh-oh, this may not be perfect, but you haven't completely annihilated your credit score and you haven't gotten to the point where, you know, you were hit that desperate phase.
You know, from what I've seen, certainly, and, you know, we work with a lot of real estate investors and they work with people who are going into foreclosure, and we have these conversations a lot. They said that the best time to work with these people is at the beginning because they're not quite shell-shocked yet. But once they get to a point where they're kind of overwhelmed with all the letters and the solicitations from other people, they just shut down and they make no decision. And that is by far the worst thing you could do. The worst thing you could do is nothing and just let it happen to you. There are a lot of options available to you during this process at different stages. Earlier is definitely better. You have more options, but you always have options up until the end. And then if you don't take them, then you're really kind of putting yourself in a hole. So if you can think clearly enough to make these decisions, that's the best time to start looking at your options. So I completely agree. What are your thoughts, Kelly? What have you seen? I mean, from an accounting perspective, have you seen this with clients? Like, how are you looking at this?
I think I read somewhere that the top consumer complaint received by the FTC is related to over-promissory trading practices on these debt consolidation programs or debt relief programs. So, you know, the concept of debt relief sounds just terrific, but, you know, it's like the devil's in the details. Is it really debt forgiveness? Is it interest rate reduction? Is it just consolidate things so you get one payment and then spread it out over a longer period of time? It tends to be sold, I think, just based on the ads that I've observed, that it's eliminate your debt. I don't think it really is elimination of debt. I think it's kind of restructuring debt into a single interest rate and a single payment spread out over a period of time. And so all I would encourage people to do is make sure that they understand what they're getting. Otherwise, you have like these mortgage loans that, you know, people, at least some of them, didn't realize that their interest rate was going to go up and doubled, and then they lose their home. I know that some of these debt consolidation companies have tiers in their interest rate. You know, it's like they start out at, I don't know, 3% over LIBOR or something like that. And then after a year, they might go up to 8% over LIBOR. So there's sleaze bags, and then there's good people in that industry, like your guest was. You know, it sounds like she's doing a good ethical job. But main thing is make sure people understand exactly what they're getting and what they're buying. And if it sounds too good to be true, it's another thing I got from my grandmother, right? If it's too good to be true, it probably isn't true.
Yeah, it's interesting. And certainly I haven't had a lot of experience with this with clients, but I do know I did speak with an accountant way back who was, and this is a different topic with debt resolution with the IRS or tax resolution, but, you know, he was telling me, he's like, well, I could probably get you 90% off the taxes you owed, but it's going to take a long time. It's going to be painful and you're going to have to deal with the stress of this. And it's like, the question was, is it worth it? Because I was asking the question, I had a client who had this huge tax bill and they couldn't pay it. And he's like, is it going to be worth it for them? Well, I guess if you're letting go of $1 million tax debt and you're let go in $900,000, yeah, maybe it is worth it. If you have debt over $9,000, maybe it's not worth all that stress. So as with a lot of things, I think it's important that people understand the process, understand what their rights are too, You know, like another area we haven't really talked about debt resolution is if these companies are coming after you, like each state has their own laws to protect the borrowers. Even though you're delinquent on your payments, there's still laws to protect you. So they can't spam you at home. They can, you know, they can't harass you. Like there's every state's different, but there's a lot of laws to protect people. So it's really important to know your rights. And, you know, we'll put that resource that Miranda mentioned in the show notes as well for people who are interested. But let's talk about some other ways that maybe retirees can deal with debt going into retirement, because I know people are getting close to retirement. If you have a whole lot of debt, that might be a challenge for you, you know, and you're trying to live off interest payments and you're paying debt payments. So what are some ways that people can deal with debt into retirement, Natalie?
I think the first thing is understand, you know, what percentage it is of whatever income that they're going to have, whether or not they're comfortable with. I think that comfort level is really important. I have some clients where we've actually taken retirement funds to pay it off so that they wouldn't have anything, and they just accumulated it because they were comfortable with a certain level. So I think going into that retirement stage is how much is their spending piece and how much do they either feel comfortable with a certain payment amount or not, and what are the consequences of potentially paying it off. But really, it's understanding, you know, what income do you have, what portfolio can you live off of, whether it's Social Security, pension, et cetera, that you've got coming in, and what percentage is it? And are they comfortable with that? Are they going to be able to live on it? And anticipating storms, right? Anticipating things happening that they haven't anticipated. And so are they going to be okay in that scenario? But really, it's starting early. Way before they're talking about retirement, you know, we had someone come in who had 500,000 assets, 500,000 in debt. They can't retire. They need to start paying that off immediately 10 years before, rather than coming in that day and saying, I want to retire tomorrow. And hey, by the way, you know, half my income is going to debt payments.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've actually had a similar story of a client who had a lot of assets, a lot of debt. And if you balance them out, it would be a zero. But some of those things, if the assets are producing income, some like real estate, sometimes that can be a worthwhile endeavor, right? It's not just because the assets hopefully are going to work for you. They're productive assets.
Yeah, except for this wasn't. This was like RV, car, credit card. I mean, every kind of consumer, personal, short-term debt you could probably imagine. Boat. Not real estate.
You mean a boat's not an investment? What do you mean?
Sure. Yeah. If you're giving people rides on that boat or you're chartering the boat, maybe.
Investing in friendship.
Yes, exactly. Make sure you have a really rich friend.
Seriously. What about you, Kelly? What are your thoughts on how retirees should deal with debt going into retirement?
Well, I think it's first and foremost, you know, there's so many facts and circumstances that are related to that. But liquidity is important for everybody, I think. I know most retired people have Medicare, and so they've got contingent health issues that are presumably covered by that. But having a certain amount in liquid assets to pay for unforeseen contingent events that trigger needs for cash is important. But assuming that they've got the liquidity needs satisfied, because I'm for people that don't have sufficient liquidity in place, then I think taking on debt to fund that liquidity is important, because it's better to use the bank's money, for instance, right, and be able to pay your bills if something happens. So having, if you got to borrow to make that happen or have that fund available, then that's important. So assuming that that part's taken care of, then there's really no need for a retired person that's kind of living on the proverbial fixed income to be taking on more debt, because then they're probably living beyond their fixed income means. I would encourage people in that phase of their life to dial back their expenses and maybe instead of going to the Bahamas, go to Key West or something, right? And, you know, to dial back some of their output.
I want to kind of mention two tactics people can use too, and then I'll ask Miranda. I'm sure she has a few as well. You know, as people get close to retirement, there are two things that are not really talked about. Well, one is highly talked about, but, you know, if you have a credit card and you're, let's say, close to the end, let's say your final 6 months of your life or what have you, and you're running out of money, you can use a credit card, and as long as you're the only person on that credit card, that debt disappears, you know, when you die. So I'm not suggesting you scam anybody, but you should understand that the credit card debt kind of disappears. It doesn't kind of roll over into other things. So, you know, that's kind of an important concept for debt in retirement. Another one is one that you probably have a whole nother show on, which is a reverse mortgage. I don't particularly like them, but there are situations where it makes sense because it's the person's only option. So if somebody is in retirement and their only asset is their real estate, you know, where they live, and they really don't have a way to monetize that, it is possible, you know, if you find the right numbers that make sense, doing a reverse mortgage may be an option for you. Now, what I find is most of them are high fees. They don't make a lot of sense. The heirs probably won't end up getting the property because the equity will all be distributed to the bank, but it is better than no solution. It's not high on my list, but it is a solution. But it's also another area that you have to really do your homework with, because it's kind of like annuities. It's just complicated. There's a lot of fees. There's a lot of nuances in there that you have to be familiar with. And it can make sense for you if you understand them, but you just don't go in there blindly because you saw some guy in a television show that you saw. I forget who the actor is pitching those now, but there's some guy pitching them, and just, I don't know. To me, it just doesn't work. But
Tom Selleck.
There you go.
Well, the other thing, remember the reverse mortgage, it could act like you were talking about, where you get it, but you don't use it, because then the interest rate is actually adding to the funds that are available to you.
Yeah.
So it's just something to think about, as opposed to just pulling it out for actual spending immediately.
Yeah. What about you, Miranda? What are your thoughts? I know you've probably have some thoughts on the matter.
Well, no, I mean, I think you need to be brutally honest, and you need to be brutally honest before the year before you want to retire, right? A lot of people I've seen don't even start thinking about retirement until like 5 years out. And while that's not the worst thing ever, the worst thing ever is thinking about retirement 6 months out. But a lot of people don't think about it very early or for very long, or think about what they want the money to do. So you'll have people who are like, oh, well, I need to build $1 million nest egg. Well, okay. So you have $1 million. Have you thought about inflation? Have you thought about the fact that you're still in debt? And how long is that $1 million going to last? And what are you going to be able to do with it when you consider inflation and your debt? So looking ahead and thinking about that, none of us like to think, oh, well, you know, that's a long way off. That's 20, 30 years in the future. But is it? But think about, you know, well, what is my money going to do for me to help me have that lifestyle I want in retirement? And if I'm being brutally honest, are the things I'm doing now going to help me with that?
Yeah. And that's really important. So let's, in the interest of time here, since we're kind of running long, maybe we can have some kind of final thoughts and where people can find out more about you. What about you, Kelly? You have any final thoughts? And then where can people find out about you?
I guess my final thought would be, don't learn to love debt, learn to hate debt, but especially short-term debt. And second would be kind of related to that. Learn to match long-term assets with long-term liabilities and short-term assets with short-term liability. That's number one. That's the second point. So that's my final thoughts. I am Kelly Coghlan. That's Coughlam. I'm CPA and CEO of Everyday CPA. You can get me at kelly@everydaycpa.com.
Great. Thanks a lot, Kelly. What about you, Natalie? Final thoughts, and where can people find out about you?
So my final thoughts would be, one, prepare. So before you get into debt, have a plan for how you're going to pay it off. And number two, get help when you very beginning of starting to feel like the wheels are coming off. Talk to a professional, use some of the resources Miranda mentioned, or someone like Leslie. And I work for Brio Financial Advisors. That's BRIAUD. And you can find us at BRIAUD.com. And I'm Natalie Pine.
Great. Thanks a lot, Natalie. And what about you, Miranda?
Yeah. So as always, you can find me at planningmoneyseeds.com, where I like to talk about figuring out what the purpose of your money is and what you want to do with it. For the most part, it goes back to what our former co-host Joe used to always say, is start with the end in mind. So figure out where you want to be, then be brutally honest about where you are now, and then make a plan to get there, to kind of bridge that gap. So head on over to plantingmoneyseeds.com. I have lots of articles on that, as well as a resources section about how I use my own money. So head on over there and check that out. But what about you, Kirk? What's happening in your world?
There are so many things happening in my world, Miranda. I don't know where to start. Yeah. So my name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager, Innovate Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth. We make your life better. You can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. We have a lot of articles on the site, some about retirement, which actually would be pretty interesting for the listeners for this show. But you can find out there in our blog, innovativewealth.com. Thank you for joining us this week on Money Tree Investing Podcast. We have some great guests coming up on the show that you're definitely going to love. I want to say next week is one I'm super excited about. It's next week's guest is a trader who made over 70% a year for 11 years in a row without a losing year. It's a fantastic interview, and I'm really excited to share this with everybody. Another guest who I'm excited about is a man of the world. I guess I would call him an international man. This guy will invest anywhere in the world. He'll meet with anybody. He'll go into the, I guess he calls them hellholes, and meet with dictators. He's just a fascinating individual, and he loves to find value even in the riskiest places on the planet. So remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also check us out at moneytreepodcast.com for more information on the show and the show notes. We'll have a lot of the resources we talked about today in those show notes if you want to learn more. And on our website, you'll have access to all these resources and as well as the archive shows. Lastly, please remember to subscribe to our show on iTunes and give us a rating as well as your thoughts. We really appreciate those and any sort of reviews you can give us. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get access to some top guests that will, I know you'll want to hear. So have a great week ahead, and remember that no one will care about your money like you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.